Blog Talk Radio.
Sing through my voice, play through my hands, let the way be
to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I hope you enjoyed part of that lovely song I opened with tonight called Let the Way Be Open by Abigail Spinner McBride. Thank you, as always, Abigail, for the use of your lovely music. Hopefully we'll be able to play that song in its entirety toward the end of the show. As always, I thank my listeners for tuning in tonight, whether it's live or if you catch us later from the archives. Please remember the three F's. Yes, I'm not sure I told you this before. The three F's. Mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Be sure to become our friend. And click on follow so that you never miss notice of my new guests each week. That way you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. All that you can do from my show page. Follow, friend, and favorite. And tonight, we have two guests for your pleasure. Very, very different guests indeed. For about half an hour, in just a few minutes, we have with us a wonderful scholar calling in from Canada, Manda Kranta Bose, and we'll be discussing her latest book, Women in the Hindu Tradition, Rules, Roles, and Exceptions. And I have your email questions for Dr. Bose right here. Then, next up for the remainder of the show, we have a lot to cover as we shift gears a bit and delve into the world of Druids and Wiccans, spiritually, politically, and culturally. It's my pleasure to have author and hereditary witch from a matriarchal clan, John Storm, on the show. And we're going to discuss a number of things, including contemporary witches versus pre-Christian witches, what his clan considers a warlock. I know that will surprise you. I doubt it's what you think at all. We'll discuss, most importantly, do Americans have a glamour, which is sort of like a spell cast over their eyes and minds, especially considering the election results of last week. After all, as John says, what kind of talisman is capable of holding the overwhelming majority of common folk in the thrall of known liars, thieves, and murderers, and who still treat the criminals as honored and trusted authorities? Well, John believes he knows how some are managing to lie to people consistently, even get caught in unscrupulous acts, and still command respect and votes from their victims, and some never see a prison cell. Well, certainly some interesting conversation for sure. But before we start, just some housekeeping issues. I want to be sure you know I have finally finished putting together the touches on the itinerary for the sacred tour I'll be leading back to Turkey for the third time next November. The tour is for women and men. We'll be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Çatalhöyük, Side, and Lagina, where we find Hecate's only standing temple known to man. We'll be doing activities like dream incubations, rituals at the site, Turkish baths, partaking of the sacred mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite, and much, much more. So if you're hearing the call for a pilgrimage or sacred journey or purposeful travel, as we call it today, that needs or need to satisfy your mind, body, or soul, then go to my website at KarenTate.com. And if there's time, I'll say more about the tour before the show ends. Again, the tour is for men and women, and we're not going to take more than 20 people, and it's already filling. So don't hesitate or delay if you want to lock in a spot. And while you're at KarenTate.com, I invite the influx of our new listeners from across town and across the globe to please check out my two books, which have garnered prestigious endorsements and awards. The first is Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. The first is even sold in museum bookstores, and the latter was a finalist in the spirituality category of the National Best Books Awards. I guess you could call it sort of a spiritual, socio-political look at embracing goddess, whether you think of goddess as a deity, archetype, or ideal. I also have free meditations, goddess gift cards, and other interesting offerings at the goddess store at KarenTate.com. Well, since our interview with Dr. Bose is probably only going to be about 30 minutes, I probably won't take callers, but like I said, I will be asking her some of your email questions you've had the forethought to send in advance. But later in the show, we will open the switchboard with our second guest, John Storm. So if you're listening live and want to call in to talk to John or myself later, the number is 718-766-4662. I know most of you do listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see your number on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and invite you to offer your comment or question. All right, all that being said, let's get right to our wonderful guest tonight, Dr. Amanda Kranta Bose. I thank her for giving us some of her valuable time tonight, and I want to start by reading her bio to you. She is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and of the Royal Society of Great Britain. She's a professor emerita at the Institute of Asian Research at UBC. She studied in the universities of Calcutta, British Columbia, and Oxford, and holds her doctorate degree from Oxford. She has many articles and 11 books to her credit, single authored as well as edited volumes. The one we're going to be discussing tonight, again, is called Women in the Hindu Tradition, Rules, Roles, and Exceptions. Two of her other books were Faces of the Feminine in Ancient, Medieval, and Modern India, and I can't pronounce that name, Sangatarania, a critical edition. She'll have to help me with that. And let's see what else. Because she certainly accomplished a lot. She taught in the religious studies and women's studies departments at UBC. Her interests are varied, and she continues to do her research in Sanskrit texts on musicology, the classical epics, and gender issues in the Indian tradition. Well, Dr. Bose, thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Thank you for inviting me. The book that you are mentioning is called Sangeeta Narayana, which is a musicological text. And okay. I have yet another book that you might be interested, The Word My Mother Gave Me.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you for that correction of the pronunciation, too. It just a little. I'd never seen the word before or heard it pronounced, so I appreciate that. Well, the book that we're talking about tonight, Women in the Hindu Tradition, the description of the book is, it accounts for the origin and evolution of the nature and roles of women within the Hindu belief system. It explains how the idea of goddess has been derived from Hindu philosophical ideas and texts of codes of conduct and how particular models of conduct for mortal women have been created. The description goes on, but you know what a lot of my listeners seem to be most interested in is, you know, what especially with some of the emails that came in, they would like to understand why in India, where goddess has never been forgotten, why is it still so patriarchal? Why does it, at least it not seem from the outside looking in, that there's equality, with the women? I know some of the women I know have said, well, you know, maybe there's still poverty and suffering because the goddesses have been domesticated, or they call it spousification, and they've sort of, you know, become wives, but maybe the full, you know, power and influence of goddess is sort of repressed a bit, so therefore the same thing happens by association with women. Is there something to that?
Well, Hindu religious culture correlates philosophical speculation and social imperatives to situate femininity on a continuum from divine to mortal existence. This creates in the Hindu consciousness multiple, often contradictory images of women, at once wielders and subjects of authority. When the goddess figure is viewed in the Hindu metaphysical tradition as the active principle of creation and source of all power, she is at the same time defined in familial terms that constrain her within the gender roles prescribed by social norms. So the implications of the duality of divinity humanized goes along gender lines. You are right. There is always this contradictory descriptions and situation that we find in India. But I don't think it has got anything to do with poverty.
Oh, well, no. I wasn't trying to say it did. Let me, maybe I needed to rephrase that. I guess, some of the people who wrote in wanted me to ask you, in this country where goddess has been revered for thousands and thousands of years, where in the West she's been forgotten and swept under the rug, goddess is such an image of abundance and compassion, but yet, in India there is poverty. So many people do suffer. I guess thinking of goddess as archetype, thinking of goddess as values, they just wonder. These ideas, is it the result of the caste system that this hierarchy that, keeps, some people at different, different socioeconomic levels, or,
Actually, this is not the right thing to think, because you are right. Goddess is still on a pedestal, and goddess is always there. But why we find this discrepancy or discrimination, subordination, it has nothing to do with caste. Caste system has something to do with, the hierarchy is pollution, purification. This is a different area. It's a very complicated area. I would urge you to read the book and you will perhaps find a little things a little bit clearer. It's very difficult to explain all these things in half an hour, but I can assure you that goddess is still up in the pedestal, and to a woman, to put her on the pedestal is always there, and human beings, a woman, like in Indian mythology, you will find Sita, Radha, these are mortal women. They were deified later because of their, divine traits of character. But what happened, or happens, the paradigm is to fit in goddess, mother, wife, daughter, they have power. Femininity has power, power of procreation. And sometimes male persona, they want to control that. It's a question of power. And caste system sometimes comes in, but if a woman from the lowest caste really feels the love of God, there is no discrimination. So it's much more complicated than just saying in clear-cut way, because of caste system, because of poverty, economic situation, some people are subordinated. It's not that. Even in the highest caste, if you do not fit into the paradigm of how women, and by doing that, women, even goddess fall into that category. Women never are given independence. That way they have tried to control even goddess. all the goddesses are connected to a male god, somebody's wife, somebody's daughter, somebody's wife, somebody's mother. That's the way the texts put them, text describe them, the whole discourse on gender, discourse on goddess, discourse on femininity, everything. Who wrote on them? Not women. Men wrote about them. So
right.
On one hand, they gave power if they are like goddess, like they are good, they are wielder of wealth, benefits, various kind of success, then they are up in the on the pedestal. If they are not like that, do not fit in the paradigm of being a good wife, devoted to her husband, good daughter, good wife, then they go down to as prostitutes or courtesans or destroyer. And there is a continuous kind of struggle to put goddesses in that familial or familial role. And although these rules are there, when I said I would like to end with a poem, I meant that within this subordinate situation, women were given education, they had property rights, everything there is there. And that has nothing to do with caste.
I see. Well, where do Hindu women, you know, in what areas are they perhaps held back most? I mean, obviously, it seems like the home is a large domain of women. You know, is there an issue with, you know, so many women, you know, working outside the home now? Or, you know, can you sort of, you know, give an idea of what the, you know, by, you know, from a Hindu standpoint, what the parameters for a woman's life is you know, usually?
Well, if you are thinking of today, it's a different situation from beginning of the 20th century or maybe 40s, 50s. Women have come out and worked far more than they used to do that before. Women's position or proper place is home. That's the patriarchal society everywhere. So even if a woman works, she comes back and looks after the kitchen, or, you know, everybody has a servant, most people has a servant. So, but she looks after that. She looks after the children. This is the norm. But today's India, if you're looking at today's India, then almost in the middle class in particular, almost everyone works. And in the lowest class, there is no question of that luxury is not there, that a woman doesn't work. The husband and wife both provide for their family. But now it's a totally different world. A woman and a man, they have the same kind of, you know, I wouldn't say most, but upper middle class would do the same kind of job, same kind of corporate work or teach or whatever, and they will earn the same amount of salary or even more sometimes. And
okay.
there is no longer any kind of problem within the family for that. I'm talking about middle class.
Right, right.
And upper class, of course, they always had this privilege.
Well,
does
now,
that
if I
answer your question?
I think so, yes, absolutely, because, you know, it's hard to understand, you know, what's going on within a culture if you don't visit the country, if you don't know people that, you know, that live in that tradition, just like I'm sure so many people have crazy ideas about what life is here is like for Americans. I'm sure some people have the distorted views. But I know, like, some of the, you know, some of the women who study goddesses, you know, they look at Kali or they look at Durga, and, you know, and they mm-hmm. see these powerful goddesses, and you know, where they may be exceptions, you know, those two, you know, powerful warrior goddesses. But in general, do you, it would seem that you know, women aren't really allowed to emulate, you know, the Durga or the Kali. It's more the role of spouse or mother. Would that be inaccurate, or am I still misunderstanding?
No. One thing first, let me say one thing, or a couple of things. One, India has more than a billion of people, so there some problems from earlier on goes on, and there are conservative people who try to hold on to their tradition and without understanding what the tradition is. And in the diaspora, why we find this kind of questions remain unanswered is that people have come here in the diaspora 30, 40, 50 years ago. Meanwhile, India has progressed. They have not. What they have thought as tradition, without looking at the texts, why I have emphasized that read the texts, because in the text, women are given property rights, women are given education, there are scholars, philosophers, umpteen number of cases. But, you know, the patriarchal society in the medieval ages, they just kept on hiding those books and denied education to women. I'm going back to 1700 BCE when women were allowed education. To answer your question on Durga and Kali, these two powerful goddesses. Now, Durga is very powerful, but Durga is looked as, you know, put as a mother with her children, Ganesha, Kartikeya, Lakshmi, Saraswati, all these children. So she has a motherly role. So she's all right. Mothers protect. With Kali, they have a problem, the patriarchal society. They made Kali looking evil because they are afraid of her power, and she's not attached to a god. So she remains independent. Independence is something they really do not like. And they control the sexuality of Shiva. She does. And that sort of thing, they're afraid of this kind of feminine. That's why Kali has been portrayed as a kind of with evil appearance. Kali is not evil. Kali takes away all the evil from the world. So she looks ugly so that the whole world can remain, undisturbed.
In balance. I understand that, and I'm sure my listeners would too. They know that Kali is very misunderstood.
There is another goddess, Saraswati. She's also independent, not attached to anybody, but she is not, creating any kind of problem for the patriarchal society, because she is the goddess of learning, and she stays with her books. She doesn't disturb anybody. She's above sexuality and everything. So that's fine with the Hindu tradition. But with Kali, they have problems, so they have to invent so many things.
Okay.
And
okay.
Stories about her. Does that answer some of your questions?
That was another question from one of the callers, my listeners who emailed in. Her name is Yona. She said, are there differences in the Tamil, T-A-M-I-L, communities of southern India? She says she believes that the women there retain pre-Vedic and non-Brahmic goddess traditions, which is village rather than caste-based. So women tend to be more involved in leaders in ritual. Is she right about that? Is there a difference?
There is a difference, because southern India, that's Tamil area, Tamil, Telugu, Kannada, all these areas, there used to be a matriarchal society, and there is she's right, they have village goddesses, but she's not right about saying that that's not the case in the north as well. There are village goddesses. They are the protective goddesses. And my book addresses that in the fifth chapter, I believe. And women are in control of these goddesses. They do all the rituals. But the Brahminical priests, they keep control of the pan-Indian, this kind of upper-class gods and goddesses. So that area is still under, very much under the jurisdiction of male, Brahmin male in the south, in the north. But women also have their space, the domestic space, where they do worship various goddesses domesticated. And it's a different area of worship.
And there was a question about Sarasvati, she is an unusual goddess. Is it true that they're at, and while you will see her image like on banks or, she's not actually, there aren't actually temples built to Sarasvati? Is that actually, am I confusing her with Lakshmi? One of them does not have temples built in her honor. Is that accurate or no?
Well, yeah, you are right, or she is right. Lakshmi has many temples, but Saraswati has very few. And Saraswati is the only goddess who is continuing from the Vedic times, which is 1700 BCE. She is continuing, and in the Vedic times, in the classical times, in modern times, she has not been touched by anybody. She is on her own. She is worshipped by everybody who aspires to be an intellectual, a poet. And she doesn't have money. Lakshmi gives wealth, and she gives knowledge and music, dance. All these artistic people and intellectual people worship her. And she does not have too many temples, but there are a couple, not too many. You are right.
Okay. Are they located in a particular part of India, the few temples that do stand in her honor?
There is one in Rajasthan, a couple in Bengal, and maybe one in Punjab, I'm not sure where. But there are many, many sculptures of his in the temple walls.
Okay.
May not be dedicated to her, the temple, but all the walls have sculptures. Many, many of them have sculptures.
One of my listeners is emailing in. When we were commenting on Kali, that she's sort of in a class of her own, and at some of the temples, though, she is. The temple is dedicated to her and her role as mother. In that mm-hmm. sense, in that particular sense, in her mother aspect, I guess do they kind of consider her a little bit less of a threat when that's the aspect worshipped in that particular temple?
Yes, that's right. And there are many temples where she's worshipped. And particularly in Bengal, where I come from. And there, Kali is worshipped as mother, and she is connected with Shiva. And Durga's another aspect is Kali. When she is angered, she becomes Kali.
Right.
Angered at some, unusual things, something she has to control, or she has to pacify, she becomes Kali in anger.
Okay.
Control. She's mother at that point.
One of my listeners is asking if you wouldn't mind commenting on you women who sort of suffer this, they become victims of bride burning. Is that a real prevalent problem still in India?
Well, in 1829, it was banned by law. But, you can put in law, but implementation is another problem. So that it still happens, even one is too many, right?
Right.
But in the shastras or the scriptures, if you look at the scriptures, you find that the scriptures specifically say God has given you the body. You have no right to let it die unless God wishes it. If you commit suicide, if you take your own life, you will go to hell. This is written in the religious texts. But what happened, you know, the patriarchal society, the Brahminical society at one point, they tried to hide this kind of writings in favor of women, and the entire dowry, this bride burning system has another problem. You know, the problem is social problem. When a young woman, woman's husband dies, the problem of inheritance, if the wife dies with him, then the property goes into the rest of the family. If she is alive, then she will have the right to the property. So it's best to get rid of her. This is one. The other problem is, unlike the entailment of the property in England in the 18th century, 19th century, which you find in Bronte's and Jane Austen's novels all the time, women are just thrown out. Here they burn the wife, so that with the property there will be no problem, inheritance, and a young woman creates problem in this family, a joint family where there are many, many young men around. So there might be some kind of entanglement, and they want to avoid it. So these are the two problems.
So a widow isn't considered, I mean, she can't remarry?
She, according to the law, she can remarry. But that was also hidden for many, many centuries. And it has been brought back and made into a law that a widow can marry, remarry. Now, from 2nd century AD or CE, we have texts that specifically say that if a husband is fallen, if a husband abandons his wife, if a husband is impotent, a woman can remarry. And if husband is dead, a woman can remarry. This is written in religious texts, sacred texts.
But that doesn't solve the problem of her inheriting his fortunes, which the family would rather just get rid of her than let her get married again.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So these are very complicated situations, social situation. Why you want to make it a kind of religious, you know, injunction that this is good for a woman to die at her husband's pyre.
I don't think Goddess would be too happy with some of these rules. Dr. Bose, we're getting to the end of the time that you sort of allocated, and I know you want to read your poem to close, but what would be one of the most important ideas you would like to leave listeners with, you know, about the theme of your book of women in the Hindu tradition? What's most important for them to know that maybe we haven't covered?
Recognizing the central place of women in the Hindu religious and ethical discourse. They kept on talking about women in all their texts. There is so central and important place of women that one must not forget. The roles and rules, the rules, there are rules, but the roles of women that they have, they had independent voice. They wrote poems after poems. And one of the poems I would like to read to you, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure.
By Meera. Let us go to that unreachable land that death fears to see, to that lake brimming with love on which swans play, and the company of sages and saints brings wisdom, the mind alight as it cleaves to the dark one, wearing ankle bells of pure thought. All dance in contentment and decked in golden bracelets, practice the 16 arts of delight in love with the dark lord, turning away from all others. This is Mirabai, 16th century poet from Rajasthan. From the South, Andhra, Mahadevi Akka writes, "I love the beautiful one, the formless one. He has no death nor decay. The beautiful, the fearless, the dauntless one. Beyond birth is he. Chenna Mallikarjuna is my lord. Take these mortal husbands and feed them to the fire in the kitchen." Can I read another?
Yeah, we'll have to probably let that be your closing.
Okay. Sorry about that. "I have no credentials in the field of phonetics. I can't spout declensions and root derivations. I'm unschooled in tropes or rhymes or rhythms, the artifice of prosody. It is not my thing either. I lack the formal training in writing poetry and composing long narratives. I haven't scanned handbooks of style or familiarized with lexicons of grammar. But only by the grace of the renowned Lord, somehow I have been blessed. I find I am able to write these verses." And she writes in 16th century, the Ramayana, and she is from the lowest class. But her
wow.
Ramayana is really well renowned.
That's lovely. Thank you. Thank you. Well, Dr. Bose, I want to thank you for being on the show. And if my listeners want to know more about your work, you have a website. Would you mind saying your website so that they can find you?
Sure. It's www.iar.ubc.ca.
Okay.
And you will have to look for my name there as faculty.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so very much. Thank you for calling in from Canada, and we certainly appreciate your valuable time. I know you're busy and you've been traveling and you've made time for us tonight. So thank you very much. Thank you.
I hope that I have answered your questions, and it was a pleasure. And I hope that we'll keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, a hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether, as I like to say, the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. You've been listening to a short interview with Dr. Amanda Kranta Bose, author of Women in the Hindu Tradition, Rules, Roles, and Exceptions. Well, it's that time when we're crossing the threshold into the next part of the show. My next guest coming up is, as I said at the top of the hour, he's a male witch. His name is John Storm. He's the author of the Witch Clan fantasy series titled Warrior of the Witch Clan and Matriarch of the Witch Clan. I just love these kinds of books because they help us remember how our ancestors lived and offered us a glimpse about what we might reclaim. Let me welcome John to the show. Get him unmuted here. Hi, John.
Hello.
Thank you for calling in. I appreciate you making time for us tonight.
Not a problem.
Well, John, did a brief intro for you at the top of the hour. I don't know whether you were listening or not, but before we start our chat, because we have lots of interesting things to talk about, I thought I would read a little bit more about you to listeners so they kind of get a more well-rounded idea about all your experiences.
Sure.
So here we go. John was born in 1953 in a family of hereditary witches that count their ancestry all too many centuries ago in ancient Tara. That's in Ireland, for those of you who might not know. He was raised and trained in the craft as the only male witch in his family by his grandmother. He says, I now have grandchildren of my own. I began serious martial arts training in 63. His sensei became a father figure, and he strove for perfection, holding a second-degree black belt in Mas Oyamas Karate, and at a master's ranking and had a master's ranking in Chinese Kempo. By the early 1970s, between training for tournaments and running his small chain of studios, he took radio and TV broadcasting at El Paso Community College in Colorado Springs, Colorado. That gave him his first taste of journalism. Then 30 years later, dying to write about all of his experiences, he wrote the series, The Witch Clan, fantasy series, which I just mentioned. These are character-driven stories with true-to-life characters and experiences melded into an entertaining fantasy. His first full-length novel was The Matriarch of the Witch Clan, and readers are encouraged to visit his website at witchclan.com, where you can also correspond with him. And I'm sure after hearing what we're going to talk about tonight, I can't imagine that you won't. Let's see. He says he and his family are registered as Witches of the World at the Witch's Voice and can be found in their archives. So, John, how far back can you actually track your family?
I think the earliest ones go back to about 6th century, about 700 A.D.
Okay, okay.
And everything beyond that, you pretty much got to infer.
Okay, all right. And matriarchal succession the whole time?
Yes, it was. Actually, there was there's a little tale in the very beginning of Matriarch, which is kind of a family story, which I've also seen pop up a couple other places or something very similar. But the tale that gets told in our family was this, like he was the last king. I don't think he was the last one, though. And Tara had three daughters and no male heirs. And a foreign prince came to visit at one particular point in his reign and ended up marrying one of the daughters. And evidently this prince wasn't human. He was of the she, the fair folk, the gentry. They got a lot of names for these people. Looks very human, but not. So the legend kind of goes on that every third generation of the children that this particular couple had was an adept witch, someone who was born with maybe a little extra talent or a bigger knack for things. The family line just kind of goes on there, but it's matriarchal, so names change all over the place.
And I think you said your grandmother was the last adept.
My great-grandmother was the last adept. My grandma, she was an adept, but after about 50 years or so in the craft, it doesn't matter a whole lot. You're dealing with a very formidable witch.
I would think so.
Yeah.
So now, how has, has this matriarchal idea, how does that sort of trickle down and affect life today for you, for your family?
It's kind of, well, this day and age is really kind of scary for me because I see a lot of things in the family. A great many, it seems less every year, really get into the craft or take up that kind of discipline. So I'm a little frightened. I don't like the idea of being the last witches or anything like that. In my own part of the family, I kind of got shunted off for at least a while because I'm a male and it's kind of a no-no in the family, but I understand that it's basically how they kept things together all these years. So when my family actually start going and a few people started actually studying the craft and are born with talents, I reestablished the matriarchy in my family, and I'm not the patriarch, I'm the clan chieftain, which really doesn't mean a whole lot at all. My eldest daughter is an adept matriarch.
Okay. So it's not like it's going to die with you. I mean, you're passing it on to your children, and hopefully they'll pass it on to their children.
Yeah, but I'm noticing I have a lot of grandsons, and boys don't come up with it quite so well as girls. my son is a great young man, but he's not really inclined towards the craft. My eldest daughter is one heck of a witch. But I got some grandsons that have some really spooky talents, and I'm thinking we're going to be training them just like we've trained girls all our lives. So we're going to do some things a little different, but we're keeping the matriarchy.
Well, and I'm curious, how extended is your family? I mean, does this branch out to like aunts and uncles and second cousins?
Oh, yeah. Most of the aunts that I mentioned in my story, well, most of them are dead now. In fact, it's been my family's recent visit with my Uncle Johnny, who I'm kind of named after. He's one of the last surviving members of that. He was never a witch. But he's been telling most of the other family to basically get comfortable, get reestablished with our roots. And now I find myself teaching nephews and nieces and stuff quite a bit more than I was a few years ago.
So within the family, realizing that it's a matriarchal clan, but then also as you're looking ahead, you have a lot of boys coming down the road. Is it an egalitarian sort of system where there's equality with the men and the women, or the women just maybe a notch up, or how do you look at it?
I would honestly say the women are maybe about a notch up. The exception of the rule has always been me. Up until now, anyway, before the grandsons are born and all that kind of stuff. And that was, I don't know what to call it, but I think it was the right thing at the right time or something like that.
You were the one there and in line. Does a man midwife? I'm not sure, quite frankly.
Actually, I did.
Is that the right term, midwife?
Grandsons.
So you can use that term for a man, that they midwife their children.
I would. I'm not really threatened by the idea.
Okay. Well, you know, I've never. The thought didn't occur to me till just now. Did you mid-husband your children? But no, you've helped bring your children and grandchildren into the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Before my wife even got a chance to hold them, I held them until their eyes opened. And the very first thing their eyes saw were my own, probably a few inches away from theirs. And the very first thing their little hands gripped, I mean, even my daughter's, was my sword. The hilt of my sword, which was quite a thing to sneak into a delivery room with you.
And she's the one that you said is turning out to be quite the witch.
Oh yeah, yeah. The oldest. I got three daughters.
Okay.
But the oldest is definitely quite the witch.
Okay.
She would be an adept witch. She's kind of born with the knack for it and everything.
I understand. Well, you know, one of the things that really drew me to you in your life is because you said to me, you come across as the real deal. I mean, so many people out there just sort of dabble at it, or, you know, they'll flock to these classes that teach them how to do sex magic or magic for prosperity or to find a lover. But it's not really a lifetime commitment with them. It's not a way of life.
It's scary, in fact.
Well, yeah. There's
so much to know when you're dealing with something. You know, you can find a wolf that will, you know, that will come to you, you know, walk up to you unafraid. But it's, you know, and you might think it's a dog and behave like it's a dog and try to treat it like it's a dog. But eventually you're going to do something that it doesn't like as a wolf because it's not a dog. And you have to know if you really want to interact safely or profitably or get something out of this relationship, you have to know really well or intimately what you're dealing with. I think the biggest part of real magic is it's more magic to the onlooker than it is to the witch. The witch knows what they're dealing with. They know it by name. They know it by nature. To the onlooker, they're just going to call it magic.
So give me an example of that, just for the heck of it.
I would say probably the very best example, anthropologically speaking, would be the old cargo cults at the end of World War II, when they saw the heavier-than-air metal planes flying through the air. And every one of those aborigines knew that, hey, anything you throw up in the air comes back down. But the people that designed those, they came up with a sympathetic magic. They started repeating, making like replicas of airstrips and stuff like that, that they had seen these big planes land in and bring these soldiers all these wonderful goods. So they, in order to, they would pray to the gods and stuff to bring these big silver birds down, and they'd build something that looked an awful lot like an airstrip. And eventually, they did get their wish. Those planes did come and left them a whole lot of oil drums and all kinds of stuff, which the natives to this day have crafted into all kinds of useful items that they've put in with their culture. But the thing about it is, between the magic and the culture, is if one of their shamans had realized what forces were brought to bear on those heavier-than-air planes that were flying, he would be probably the most famous or legendary shaman of his time. He would understand how that the law of gravity was not defeated, it was superseded. Forces of lift, thrust, weight, and drag working together would give him flight. This guy could make a hang glider and maybe fly to the next island. And before the eyes of all of the villagers and his people, he would be the most marvelous mage in their history. But essentially, and what it always boils down to, though it's not always as mundane as I just made it, is essentially he knows something they didn't. He understands something they didn't. And he applied it, and he brought it to bear, and that's when the magic happened.
Gotcha.
Kind of like people turning on their TV. They might not understand how it all got there, but they expect a picture
right.
from somewhere far away to come on when they turn it.
Gotcha. Well, you know, one of the I really love that essay that you have on the internet, and I'm going to want to make sure we mention how people can read it. But in that essay, you were talking about the pre-Christian witch versus maybe what witches are today. And I'll just say it. I think in a lot of cases, you know, witches are shadows of their former selves, of their ancestors.
Yes, we are.
Could you, I thought you it was beautifully put, just beautifully put. Would you share some of that? If you can still remember what you wrote,
actually,
with listeners.
Actually, I got it before me here. I can just pull it up on the screen here.
Okay.
Where did I put that? I think it might be in the rants.
Rants. That's a good rant. That's a good good word for it.
Yeah.
You know, because,
so witches,
you know, while you're looking for it, I think I'd like to make the point that it's just a sore spot with me right now. But there's so much that we've lost that we have to reclaim.
Yes.
You know, whether we're talking about the word liberal or whether we're talking about socialism, which we're hearing in the news so often, or the word witch. I mean, these words have become demonized unnecessarily and really out of ignorance. Priestess, the word priestess too. I really do think we have to reclaim these phrases and also reclaim what they mean, you know, for our society to function better than it is.
Well, I believe so too. I believe I really love the word that J.K. Rowling gone and coined, muggles. But essentially, we ourselves, well, I wouldn't quite put the weight entirely on our shoulders, but we got to carry some of it. We ourselves are about as responsible as they for what has happened. I know in my own family, we always kind of lived like that when my cousin and I came out of the broom closet in about 1970. I know the rest of the family really kind of chided us about it, how dangerous it was. And at the time, we didn't think so because people were just starting to, Duke University was just opening up a course in witchcraft and everything, and people were talking about it all over like it was really chic, you know. I remember my aunts telling me in Leona, you know, got to remember the burning times. And we says, no, Grandma, they don't burn us no more. Now they invite us to parties. And we really thought we were doing the right thing at the time, but I don't know. I kind of learned some hard lessons after that.
Now you're in Colorado? You're in Colorado, John?
Yeah, some of those parties was more like just a personal freak show, you know, see the strange person.
You were on display? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, yeah, that's what it felt like more than anything. But it did kind of get us out there, and of course I'm very beholding to the Wiccans, because I think if it was left to the hereditary witches, we'd still be in a world of trouble. The Wiccans that came about around the 1950s were a bit more vocal. They got the political clout, or got the a lot of the stigma off of us,
mm-hmm.
more
by
than
teaching
we did
about,
ourselves, that's for sure.
By teaching, you think, and raising awareness?
I do. Actually, I'm applying myself more to it these last couple years than I have in the past. For a long while, I didn't like Christians and Muggles, and didn't feel like I particularly owed them much of anything good. They could stew in their own ignorance, and I was kind of dark that way. But now I've been finding more and more people and that were caught up in different things that really need us.
Mm-hmm.
There was a thing that I mentioned in that essay. I didn't mention it so well in the little video that I did. But we had there was a practice we used to have called fostering. And, you know, if somebody showed an aptitude for mechanics or something like that, he might foster with a blacksmith somewhere. They show an aptitude for music, they might foster as a bard or you know, musician or something along that line. You know, if they have seem to be blessed with a lot of intuitive gifts, dreaming, divination, any of a number of things like that, they're psychic, they would probably end up being fostered either as druids or witches, depending on whether they are more solar or lunar in nature. But that's the thing the world is missing today. Everybody has been completely cut off from their roots. I have met people over the years. I remember meeting a young man back in about the early 90s. And this fella, his parents were, well, they were rocket scientists. I mean, literally, they were engineers for Lockheed Martin. He lived in Southern California, and this kid was about to commit suicide because no matter what he did, no matter what, how often they'd send him to a psychiatrist, this kid was having visions of all these things happening, and he was under attack. And his parents couldn't understand it. They're scientists. If you can't get it in a test tube, it don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
They're well-meaning people. They weren't really unloving or anything. It's just they have been so cut off from their roots. And there's nobody in this society to look at you. If you're going to trust the Muggles or the Christians, they're going to look at you and say, it's of the devil.
Absolutely.
The biggest,
yeah,
number one explanation for everything they don't understand. But, you know, back in the old days, if a witch was present, well, you have this gift, you have second sight, or you have your clairaudient, or, you know, and this can be developed, you can understand this, and other things will open up for you as you get to understand it more. But they don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're thinking they're crazy, they're thinking they're a failure, because you couldn't possibly know something that's going on the other side of the world. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But, this is where I've saved a number of people that have been in a very similar situations. They're either A, dabbling, but the reason they're dabbling, you can't blame them, is because they sense something. They know it's there. They can feel it. They got to have it. But that doesn't mean they understand it, or even that it may be dangerous.
Well, or,
you know,
or
maybe
the
a
teachers,
right way or a wrong way to approach it.
And they don't have the proper teaching to know what to do with it.
Right. All of those teachings are completely lost to them entirely. They don't even believe those things exist. And then, of course, doubting that, how are you going to deal with the reality? If it doesn't exist, but there it is, well, then it's got to be you. You need to kill yourself.
And it just makes you feel that much crazier. Well, were you able to pull up that essay?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you want me
and
to read it from the beginning or just the part about the teachers and stuff?
The way you know your people used to be looked upon. I forget where it was in the essay, but you said how beautifully, how much they were an integral part of society before. So go ahead.
Okay. In a society that distinguished their clans and factions by colored tartans, a witch's black or a druid's white robes would distinguish them as a neutral power, thereby allowing them to travel without harm and guaranteed a warm place at the hearth wherever they set foot. That same power would be occupied in trying to save as many lives and mend as many wounds as possible for all the clans, as we were responsible to the whole of our society. We were the magistrates who negotiated truces and treaties between warring factions and property disputes. We crowned or established chieftains and kings and advised on the planting and harvesting of crops and husbandry. Our bards were the traveling anchormen and spin doctors of the day, going from town to town with the latest little ditties of the valorous deeds or even the follies of some of the neighboring or distant dominions, thus swaying the masses to one cause or another by musical object lessons and catchy little limericks that politicians still make use of to this very day to get their ways. We were the teachers of our people and our children, passing down our values of old, our connection to Danu, Mother Nature, the Earth. As we watched our village children growing up, we would spot talents and inclinations and arrange a practice called fostering, where a young boy of a good build and a mechanical aptitude may have it arranged by their village mage to spend a period of time apprenticing to a blacksmith in a neighboring clan to see those skill sets passed down and benefit our people as a whole. Likewise, a child who dreams well or shows strong intuitive traits might be set up to apprentice with the druids or witches in any number of our craft disciplines, other than the mumbo-jumbo that the ignorant popular culture of this present day likes to believe of us. The word witch in our ancestors' language meant wise one. It never meant old hag, and a crone was a very powerful and honored thing to be and beloved of all for her years of service and wisdom. She would have delivered, healed, and eventually buried most of the people who knew her. The times when a witch or a wizard might be despised came much, much later, along with the Christian patriarchs.
Well, you know, what we're talking about is really a cultural, a religious genocide, and I don't think we ever really talk about it in those terms. You know, it's sort of just accepted that it was the natural course of things that that witches would be rightly decimated by incoming Christianity, because after all, you were of the devil, weren't you?
It wasn't really. I have to remind myself this often, because I can get real negative towards Christians, though I tend to deal with it never turned me off from becoming anyone's friend. I deal with people as individuals, not as groups. But as a group, it's one of my biggest sores under my saddle all these years. What they brought, I don't think it was the Christianity that was a bad thing. I remember I've read a lot of things, some of the scenes and sayings of our ancient culture, and a lot of things about Christianity, about Christ, were foreseen hundreds of years before he was even born. The Catholic tradition says there was three magi or wise men that came to see him. The biblical account just states it as being plural. It doesn't give a number. It would have been a lot more than three if they were going to ride a caravan and expect to live longer than 50 miles into their trip. But among those witches or druids, in fact, if you would have wrote the thing in Gaelic instead of the King's English, you would have said three witches came and visited Christ. And basically, our people, even from Stonehenge, foresaw the birth of the God King in the house in the house, Pisces, the house of the Hebrews. You might say it was our people that actually financed his 12 years out of the country in Egypt and gave Herod the wrong information so he wouldn't track the boy down and kill him. So, you know, the Christians
where does that come from, John?
We were there.
I haven't heard that before. So explain that to me a little bit.
They were mages. They studied the stars. They were in the craft.
Oh, okay. So that's what you're saying. Oh, okay. I'm fine.
Among the Celts, it was a single religion of witches and druids. The druids represented the solar part. Pliny the Elder, a Roman or Greek historian like way, way back, described them as two horns of the same bull. That was his quote. They were two aspects of the same religion or the same group. The witches were lunar in nature. The druids were solar in nature. Tend to have a lot more males as druids, but there were druidesses as well. Same with the witches. Women tend to work more on monthly or lunar cycles than men, but growing up in the family I did, I kind of catch on with it too. I don't even have to see that there's a full moon to know when it is. But there were other types of mages besides just the witches and druids. There were magi all over the place. Now, among these magi, first, maybe I should establish this. A lot of things about definitions are where a lot of things are getting hung up, where understanding is not happening for a lot of people. For one, their understanding of what a witch is. For two, their understanding of what a spell is. A spell, by my grandmother's definition, and we used to have to memorize it exactly this way because it does tell you something. A spellcraft is a whole, it's not just a thing of reciting gibberish and waving a stick at something. A spell is a period of time, like a dry spell, a sunny spell, a rainy spell, sit down a spell, dizzy spell. A spell is a period of time where a certain influence or influences are brought to bear to accomplish a desired goal. Now, we can be talking about something mundane, or we could be talking about occult energies. And you may just need one influence, or maybe the kind of thing you're trying to push requires a lot of horsepower, and you'll bring about several different influences to accomplish the same goal. And it's a method of problem solving for just about anything. Give you a good example. Everybody in the world uses spells. It's just witches are a bit more structured and purposeful about how they go about doing them and getting them to happen. For instance, if you're having your significant other over for a dinner, you have a plan. There's a certain idea you want this evening to end up with both of you really in a warm, cuddly, sweet place. In the process of getting there, before that significant other comes over, you clean up the apartment. Everything must look nice. You pick out clothes that accent or showcase your best features. The food that you choose may be something for its aphrodisiac qualities. We might choose some strawberries, maybe some chocolate or some sweet red wine. We're going to choose some music. We're not going to let want to hear Let the Bodies Hit the Floor by Drowning Pool or something like that. We're going to want something smoother and sweeter. We're going to have a candle light on our table for our dinner. We're going to bring the center of attention to a smaller area and a candle to soften our features to make us look better. Everything we pick is to influence, to bring us to that part of the evening where our significant other is spellbound.
Mm-hmm.
And we have everything we wanted out of this particular evening. And that is a successful spell. It took planning. It was purposeful. It had influences to bring about a desired goal. You pushed in all the right parts, places to get what you want. You didn't trust luck. You made your own. That's a witch.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so you have these people, they're learning these crafts. Spellcraft is one of them, necromancy, sorcery. There's a whole bunch of them. It just goes on and on. It's no simple thing of waving a stick or interpreting a dream or something like that. There's a whole pantheon of disciplines that goes with this. Some people have better knacks for one thing than another. And in the realm of being a witch or a druid or a mage of some sort, you're going to specialize, much like doctors or anybody else. So some people are going to be better magistrates. Some people are going to be better bards. Some people are going to be better healers. But they're all witches. They're all the same thing. Now, among these groups, now a witch's power, there's a sign that gets made, two fingers under the eyes. Well, the two fingers stand for the will and the word. For which it is our power base. It's what gives us our authority. And if you think about it, it carries a whole lot of weight, and especially if you're fanatic about it. And none of those, your word or your will, are ever to be broken. One thing you never try to do is break a witch's spirit, or if you can, it isn't going to be much of a witch anyway. But when the sign, Witch's Honor, it basically portrays that your will and your word are in effect all the time. Whether they used to say that to judge a person, everybody's going to tell you they're honest, but what are they doing when they don't think you see them?
Right.
All right. To the witch, there's more than just the muggles. We know there's other powers that are invisible that are see us all the time. There's nothing we can do that's a secret that another witch can't find out. My grandma used to tell me constantly, witches are secrets are for those who allow them to be. And it kind of meant two things, but anybody could know your secret. So as a witch, when you said like witch's honor, basically you're saying your will and your word were unbreakable, whether you see me or those invisible powers that be see me. So when I invoke something, when I say something, if I say something among men or among the villagers, well, if I've gauged everything that I've said to be true, to be honest, to be as diligent as I can come up with, they have learned over those years or their experience with me that every time I open my mouth, it means something. Listen, pay attention, give me due respect, give me due ear or reverence or whatever, but get the job done. The same applies when I walk into a room and maybe it's full of some kind of mischievous spirits or something like that. If I command this room to be still, to leave, to whatever, they know they got to listen to me too. They won't press it. I'll go through fantastic lengths to keep my will and my word. And there's still a little bit of a bleed over that. I've heard about a lot of your travels and stuff, but if you've ever visited any of the Gaelic lands, you know, Wales, Scotland, you know, England, you know, the countryside, Ireland, if you go to any one of these villages, any of them, you're gonna find one thing that got in common. Well, a number of things probably, but one thing is they always have some personage, man or woman, whose claim to fame is basically how far they'll go to keep their word. If they tell you something, they'll go through astronomical lengths to make sure that it's so.
Well, that's sort of a quality in short supply these days, wouldn't you say?
Well, it used to be our way of life.
Right.
For all of us. the will and the word. Now, among these other mages, there were those that didn't necessarily subscribe to that. That's a little difficult to do, to be very careful about what you say, and sometimes you may want to promise somebody something, or maybe say something to that sweet-looking guy or gal that isn't necessarily true, just so you can get somewhere illicit with them. And these other people were a lot like that. We call them warlocks. It means oathbreaker.
Well, that's what I wanted to get into, but I want to just go back just a tad, because I want to make sure
okay.
we mention Dionne Fortune. I was thinking about her as you were talking about, the powerful witches, the ones who stood for so much and protected and took care of the communities. Well, mm-hmm. It's pretty well known that Dionne Fortune in World War II, she was among witches that were doing spell work to keep mm-hmm. the Germans off British soil. And I just felt like I wanted to throw that in because, here's someone that, we'll never know how, what influence she really exerted, but, Britain was never.
Well, even when you got like a parish of Christians, they get together and invoke the Holy Spirit to get some kind of protection. They too have just created a spell. They invoked deity to be their influence to get that which they which they desired, their goal.
Yeah.
That,
well, I think of it as focus.
Everybody does it. Witches are just a bit more purposeful and specific in it.
And
in
use
fact,
the elements. Use a lot of the natural elements.
So long, it also gives us our one stereotypical character trait that probably irks people the most. And that's, we tend to be meddlers.
Meddlers?
Yeah, can't resist it sometime. You see somebody come walking in and they are just, how many victims have you ever met? Victims of circumstance. No matter what, that circumstance is going to just move their life all over and create all kinds of havoc. And you kind of see them and you understand them and you see what's moving them and you think, geez, this guy needs a hand or this gal needs a hand. She's been picking out bad boyfriends that's been abusing her, and the guy she's got now has got a greaser haircut and a lot of tattoos, and you can just pretty much guess where that's going as he's sucking on that beer. And, for me, it's kind of like I'm going to be picking up the phone and, tell her, this is the blood lab. Okay, yeah. Tell her that the test came out positive. Okay, her lover ain't going to like that. Hang up the phone, and I just influenced him to get the hell out of Dodge.
For her own good. I
do
see meddler. Meddler for her own good. Well, and I do want to mention to listeners, you're a big believer in karma. What you put out comes back to you threefold. So,
absolutely.
We're not saying anything here to meddle in a sense that, would cause harm.
No. In fact, that's one of the things that the warlocks or let's say those bad mages, those bad people that understood the craft, they understood a lot of things about moving people and motivating them and getting them to do what they wanted. But, okay, these people don't have much scruples. Okay, and these are the guys
so that's
that eventually
what you're calling the warlock.
When they came in.
Let's just backtrack. Let's just backtrack a minute. I want to clarify the idea of warlock, because I think most people think warlock is just a male witch. So you need to redefine how you're defining warlock.
Well, like I says, with the witch, there's the will and the word. For us, well, actually, a lot of these are Christian things, but some truth is universal. It doesn't matter whether it's a Christian or Buddhist or Hindu, they're going to tell you the same thing because it's true no matter who says it. But one of the things, to whom much is given, of them shall much be required. If you have the skills and the gifts and you're trained in the craft, essentially, we wear black. You're not even allowed to wear your own tartan, your own family's tartan, because you're neutral, regardless. If they're at war with another clan, you're going to do the same for that other clan that you do for them, and your oath is going to be worth something. Now, among doctors, there's what's called the Hippocratic Oath. But a lot of them, now that doesn't even mean to them anymore what it meant years ago when they first had it. So a lot of doctors nowadays are warlocks. That Hippocratic Oath is basically, this promise says that no matter what, you don't care if the person's a criminal or murderer or what, if you see them wounded or dying, you're going to do everything in your skill to save their life. Okay? And that's your Hippocratic Oath. But let's take a doctor that's, I know it's a hot topic, doctor that's doing abortions for money. I'm not talking about saving some woman's life or something like that. I'm just talking about somebody just can't keep her legs closed and just keeps popping out babies and keeps having them killed. I'm not talking about her at all. I'm talking about the doctor that did this for money.
Or you could say the doctors that doctors who give, you know, who get people hooked on prescription drugs. I mean, you know, there are a lot of doctors.
That's another good point, especially something that may prove to be more hazardous to them than the thing they got.
Or unnecessary surgeries so that they can make their Porsche payment or something.
Absolutely. That's where we're coming into the Oathbreakers. They're in an aspect of the craft. Necromancy and stuff like that was where your AMA and most of your medicine was learned and studied and culled from. But he represents a part of the craft. It's a part of the old craft. He has his promise. There's more than just an intellectual head knowledge. You'll see in a lot of the old symbols, the triskelies. Those are significant also of basically that every man and woman is a trichotomy. You're a body, soul, and spirit. Each of those is you individually and collectively. So there's a spiritual side to things. There's not just the intellectual side of being a doctor and healing somebody because you have the knowledge. There's a spiritual side. It has to stand for something. You want to bring life. You want to save life. You want to benefit, be a benefit to people, not just yourself but to others. And that's what a witch is. Now, a witch that doesn't necessarily have that freaking calling, now we got a whole bunch of people with all kinds of knowledge and all kinds of power to get their way with things, but they don't necessarily have the scruples. They don't care about the law, the threefold law. In fact, most of them that I know that don't particularly care think they got some kind of loophole that's going to get them off the hook, and I think they're nuts.
Well, this is where I want to segue into what I really our sort of our hot topic was going to be tonight, because you don't believe that the ignorance that's out there in our, you know, in across America is a failure of the educational system, racism, bigotry. You think that there's a good chance that these warlocks, these oath breakers, people who I'm sure wouldn't consider themselves either. I mean, I'm sure they wouldn't choose those labels for themselves. But
no.
These ones that are deceiving
people. No, those are the labels
people,
we gave them, and that was a very long time ago.
But you think they have literally cast a spell or a glamour over so much of the country because...
Sure.
So how would they have accomplished that? By what means?
Okay, all right. Let's go back to the definition again. It's a period of time where an influence or influences are brought to bear to accomplish a desired goal. That is the thinking. That is the structure. Most witches don't really hop back to a book somewhere and look up something for a spell. Most witches actually craft the spell to the circumstances they're dealing with. So you study your situation, and you find out what influences you can use. And in every sense of the word of spellcraft, the science, the study, and everything, if you look at our world, our particular society today, because it stands out like a sore thumb, because there's so many things that we promote, but we have this image of ourselves as being the good guys, the heroes, the sweethearts of the world and everything like that, but nothing is really further from the truth when you get down to exactly what we are. People intend to be well. They mean well. A lot of them are very nice people. But the things being carried out by our government and by, you know, different aspects of it most of which are Masons, which is part of that particular group, they are carrying out things. I mean, those are the influences. They got control of the school system. When I was a boy in the 50s and 60s, in America, if you were a student in an American school, you were one of the smartest people in the world. As a general, our general education back in the 50s and 60s ranked us tops in the world at the time. But since the 60s to the 70s and the things that they have initiated in that time, we've fallen behind. Here in New York, in Rochester, New York, the schools that I go to, the schools that I can look at looking out the window now, are behind third world countries. You can be a bush baby in Kenya and have a better education than 90% of the kids on the streets here in Rochester, New York right now.
And you think this is on purpose?
Absolutely, because it all serves somebody. And
okay.
Somebody's raking it in. And they've been raking it in for ages. Like, I come from a witch clan, but we're not the only ones to actually ever do that. Warlocks have been doing that for ages.
But John, how do they glamour so many kids
as to how to control a dynasty?
But John, how do they glamour so many? I mean, I would say off the top of my head, you know, the 24/7 pounding of Fox News, you know, that would be the first thing that would come to my mind. But are you talking about beyond that?
Beyond that, in every aspect of our life. You can pull out a dollar bill right now, and you can look at the occult symbolism on them. There's one aspect, but we're using influences more than just that. We're even using influences in church, things where the religion is one of love. I got my first doctorate in theology, so I've read that book, and I understand it, and I don't have a problem with it, which was really a surprise to me, because I was all witch. Didn't even like Christians. Yeah, but the thing is, though, the way it gets twisted, the way people find ways to, we become the exceptions. Yes, God said, thou shalt not kill, but he wasn't talking about these other guys. These guys are really bad, so we can kill them, do God a favor. Like, you know, well, he's a great and wonderful God. He created, he calls all these things into being. Why can't he, if he don't like it, and if it's really detrimental, why can't he just unmake it? He made them, he takes them away. It's not our place. If he put them on this earth, it's not our place to take their lives, unless it's to save our own. But if that's not the case, then you have no business killing people. But Christians are killing people all the time
in really horrible ways. Yeah, and I mean, and they feel it's fine because they're justified by God. But I guess you
see they're being moved to something, they're believing something, they're doing something that is categorically against everything they claim to believe.
So you're saying they're using the belief system, the belief system of the religion to program and manipulate, as if that's part of the spell.
Right. Joseph has a dream, it means something, it's wonderful, it's from God. You have a dream, it's of the devil.
Okay. All right, well, let me ask you about this. Do you know, have you heard about secret squares?
Secret squares?
Yeah, well, and forgive me, because I thought this might have been part of the glamour, but it's either in the Kabbalah or it's part of Freemasonry or there's an overlap or something like that. But it's what I was reading about was one of the reasons the United States was so successful in becoming the power it was, is because so many of the earliest cities were built on these grid systems, which were actually secret squares. And these squares were like part of the center of town where there was lots of activity. So, you know, just people going and coming in circle and round, it's sort of added energy, like a spell, you know, to the, you know, what was best for the country. I'm doing a horrible job of explaining this, but I'm wondering if that isn't part of it as well. You know,
it all interlocks. It's like looking at a big like a mandala. There's all kinds of patterns and things going on within there that interrelate and interlock with each other. Like I say, all of these things are joined together. Everything about our culture, our money, our school system, when you go to church, you're getting the same thing. However, if you don't go, interestingly enough, now here's where the peer pressure goes. If you don't go to one of their favorite churches, you've got a problem. Socially, they're going to give you problems. You're a Mormon instead of a standard kind of Christian. This kind of causes things this warps your perspective a little bit. When they tell you something, they want a certain image to come up in your mind. When they talk to you about witches, they want you to see the green-faced hag with the warts on her nose. They don't want her to see a lovely young lady or a lovely older woman or a guy or anything like that who might have a halfway decent IQ or an idea of what he's doing. They want you to see some crazy-looking old hag. So if you're in this particular group or this particular group, they're going to give you that. When Halloween comes, that's the picture you're going to put up on your door.
Right.
That's what you know as a witch.
Okay.
What you know as anything else, what you know as a communist. Wow, it's like a really bad thing. You know, when I first met some communists, I thought, well, geez, this isn't so bad. I'm all American. I mean, I love my country. I'm not crazy about my government at all, but I love my country. But I couldn't
I think I see what you're saying.
Kill people just because they were communist.
It's all of these. So really, the glamour, the spell,
mm-hmm.
it manifests. From a lot of different directions, whether it's
absolutely.
You ever
belly dance?
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, that's the most wonderful place. We used to call it goddess dancing, but that's the most wonderful place to really understand the function of a glamour. Glamour always takes something and makes it seem like something more than what it is. It builds it up. It magnifies it. It really brings something home. But when you learn, when you get out on the stage and you're belly dancing, you learn just even from your posture, the way you're standing. You know, you put your shoulders back, you raise your rib cage, you tuck your pubis a little bit, you raise your chin, you're smiling, you command the room. I've seen belly dancers. I remember this one woman. She was, I thought, you know, seeing in her civilian clothes, you know, or city clothes, she's kind of fat and dumpy and not the prettiest woman that you ever seen looks wise. She was a wonderful person, but just trying to give you an idea. But when she came out, she was also a very good belly dancer. I was about intermediate level. She was higher than me, obviously. But anyway, she got out on there and I thought, oh, this poor woman. But that was not what happened. She knew her craft. She got out there. That chin was high. Her posture was wonderful. She did this double helix thing with these veils that was just out of this world. She commanded everybody. There wasn't a person in that room that didn't think that woman was beautiful.
Okay.
That's commanding a glamour. That's putting it out. That's emphasizing it and embellishing it and burning it into somebody's memory is that. Well, that's what they've done with these other things, and they've used a number of influences to bring that all about. And these things kind of interlock with each other, you know, between the healthcare system, corporations starting to run more and more of our stuff now, the things that had happened to the school system, they're actually dumbing them down. Most of these kids don't understand anything about the government we're supposed to have as a
right.
constitutional republic.
Right.
They
right.
don't understand it. So if you take their rights away or you start changing things, well, we're going to make a new law or a bill for this, that, or the other thing. They don't really understand what they're learning, what they got,
what
it makes it easy to take away.
All right. I get that. I'm with you. But now this next piece of it, though. I mean, now let's talk about the people who still have a brain or half a brain. If if they see that they are consistently being lied to, if they see that their quote leaders or people in authority are caught in unscrupulous acts, how do they continue to just defy the people's logic?
They put them to sleep. That's where they lull them. That's where it starts. The influence is a lot like that of a drug. And in some cases, it actually is. They start forcing kids to have Ritalin and stuff in school. They did my nephew. And it didn't do him any good. Didn't do anything good for him. There was no good thing that came from giving that kid Ritalin.
Well, you know what I'm thinking, John. You're saying
that
you're
isn't
saying,
the only way they do this, though.
Well, you're saying asleep. Like I'm thinking about how the media wants us to care about Britney Spears. You know, mm-hmm. when you know we don't really know what's even going on in Afghanistan. I mean, that's a way of putting us to sleep. The bread
absolutely.
And circuses idea.
And you got that on the news, didn't you?
Yeah.
So the news was pretty doggone boring.
Right.
And that's
right.
What it left you with. The things that should have alarmed you or should have alerted you, you didn't get much of. The things that was going to bore you to death or just be so doggone inane, you kind of got that. You got lulled to sleep while, you know, because, it wasn't the world's greatest news about Britney Spears, and there was all kinds of news that they didn't cover. And they're really good for that. That's the whole, their whole spin doctoring thing.
Okay.
And they're
controlling
so much of the media.
Okay, so because we have probably about only 15 minutes left. So the important thing, how do we begin to counter this glamour? I mean,
education, when you can see it. A lot of people have gotten to the point where they've gotten so much input coming in that they're just plain burned out, and I don't know if we're ever going to wake them up. It's like, yeah, I've heard it before. Other people, if I command you, I don't care how good of friends we are, all right? If I tell you that you got to pick that up, the first thing, your shoulder's going to jerk or your head's going to jerk or your jaw's going to jerk. But no matter how good of friends we are, I could be the most wonderful guy you ever met. But the fact that I commanded you to do something, you're going to hesitate for a minute. And you're going to think, should I or should I put this guy in his place? And you may just go along and say, yeah, he's a good guy and he means well and I'm going to do it anyway. But your first impulse is to resist. Now, the reason most of the people aren't resisting is they don't know they're being commanded. They don't know they're being manipulated. If I want you to clap two times, I can either tell you to clap two times or I could go, dut, 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 and you'll do it two times.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll think it's your idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I led you to that.
Right.
If you can see, if you can understand when they're leading you to something, when they're keeping something from you and when they're leading, and you start noticing it and it starts actually making a difference, then you start resisting. When you know that they're, when you see aspects of the craft, they're applying this little trait on you, reverse psychology. You notice, if you ever seen people argue and then somebody tries to use reverse psychology, the minute the other guy knows that it's reverse psychology, it's not working.
Right.
He doesn't know, he's going to go with it. So actually the best education or the best breaking of a spell is an education, showing them that they are being goaded into this or that, seeing the effects. Don't you feel this way when he says that? Doesn't it make you feel like doing this? Now let's take a look at what he's really done. We see what he says. We see the impression he's trying to give us. But what's the truth? And when
you know
the truth behind it, you see him for exactly the scoundrel he is.
Well, I just had a flash, and I hope witches around the country are listening and think about this if they haven't already come up with this, quote, spell. I'm thinking about Fox News, how, you know, I feel like they just pound people daily and with lies and distortions and, you know, whip up divisiveness and hate and fear and all of that stuff.
That's
thinking
their
about
bards.
So they're bards. They're oathbreaker warlock bards.
Right.
So,
they got the whole craft. They're just not using it for nice things.
Gotcha. So, perfect. So what needs to happen to them is somebody over at Fox needs to mess up, and they need to catch Sean Hannity or Glenn Beck when they don't think they're on the air, you know, and
mm-hmm.
have them say, boy, we sure are duping these suckers, aren't we? You know?
Absolutely.
And wouldn't that just that would spread like wildfire? Can you imagine? Or if that happened to Rush Limbaugh, if somehow that could
if you got whole covens and groups focusing intent, a specific intent on somebody to mess up or show their true colors.
Right.
I've done similar little spells myself, on occasion, somebody's in the room and everybody's starting to get lulled into this song and dance, and I know this guy's got an agenda that just isn't kosher at all, and the best I can do is I'll put something out there to trip him up. I'll make his nature known. This guy may say he respects women and he wants to come over and get involved with this little coven activity or something like that, skyclad, but he's actually out to pick up chicks. And if I put something out there like, what a great rack that woman's got or something like that, and this guy jumps up and jumps right on that and runs with it, and it's kind of like, we know where you're coming from. We just put that out.
Well, or I'm thinking that simple little mirror spell I was telling you about. You know, that
mm-hmm.
way you're not in a position where you have to worry about the threefold law, because you're not really doing harm to anyone. You just put a mirror in front of the picture of somebody, and it's the idea that whatever they put out will reflect back at them.
Well, it's not necessarily just harm. Sometimes witches, actually, this used to happen a lot. My grandma used to do it to me all the time. Sometimes she'd lay some pretty rotten stuff on me, some heavy stuff. And it wasn't she was being mean. She was bringing a lesson to me.
Mm-hmm.
So what might be harm? Well, it's like, I'm going to survive it. It's going to be difficult. But I'm also going to come away from it learning something. I'm going to know something.
Right.
And so, sometimes it may be kind of like, we're witches. They're like children, and sometimes you got to give them a little spanking. Sometimes they need a little spanking to, get their priorities straight. And so sometimes the things that you're going to bring them are going to be kind of harmful in a way, but it's the overall healing that you're trying to bring. That's the goal of your spell. If just to show him spook the prey so it doesn't know that the lion's hiding in the grass, well, that'll help too. The lion's going to go hungry. Yeah, it's going to affect him, but the prey's going to live.
So in other words, if you do the mirror spell, say, for instance, with Glenn Beck, it's not
mm-hmm.
just so that he gets back whatever he puts out. It's also
mm-hmm.
the idea, the intention is to educate the populace so that so the glamour can be broken.
Absolutely, because everything we do, it doesn't matter for witches, comes back on, whether it's good or bad, comes back on us threefold. It does the same to Glenn Beck. He probably doesn't think so, but it really doesn't matter what he believes. It's going to happen that way anyway. Now, with a witch, that can come at you a couple different ways. That's not just in the sweet by and by like the Christians believe. It could be right in the right here and now when that thing comes back. Now, as a witch or as a human being, I want to learn my lessons now. I don't want to wait and learn in the hereafter that I've really been screwing up.
Right.
Because somewhere along the line, I'm going to have to make that right before I advance any further. Okay, so if I can do that, if I can get that done in the right here and now, it is much better for me in the hereafter. I go in with considerably more power and prestige.
Okay. Well, I think probably the last question we're going to have time for, I know in one of the email exchanges you and I had, you were talking mm-hmm. about there's symbols and signs out there that you can sort of spot the evidence that, maybe spellcraft is afoot, that's working
yes.
on the masses. What would some of the signs and symbols be?
Well, that two-pointed, two points up pentagram, that one comes up an awful lot. And there's this whole Luciferian satanic thing underlying it. when I was a boy in my grandma's house, we didn't really think of as Satanists as witches. To us, they were naughty Christians. You know, the Christians believe this is good, and the other guys, well, they believe the same thing, except the other thing is good, and the other guy's got it wrong.
Well, witches
but it's the
don't
same
believe
book,
in,
and it's the same mythos.
But witches
you know?
don't really believe in Satan, right?
No,
I mean,
we didn't have a Satan. We didn't have a it was like a salvation by works type of religion in our house. Essentially, because of the threefold law, the idea of cursing somebody during that day was ridiculous. Nobody in their right mind is going to do it, knowing it's going to come. You know, it's like throwing a brick up in the air and three come down on your head. It's like,
right.
No way. You can't call yourself wise and do something like that. No witch in their right mind is going to worship something evil. Maybe something dark, but not something evil. And, so a witch gets up, and generally, if you're wise, you're going to look for all kinds of opportunities to do good things, you know, random acts of kindness and stuff. You don't worry about the other guy paying you. You know karma's going to bring it along threefold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you can do good things for people, not say anything, move on your way, because you know it's coming. It'll know where to find you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but the signs and the symbols of the oath breakers. What would some of those be? I mean,
well, they like to sing. Well, among a lot of the warlocks, you hear the word mystics or mystifies. Well, to mystify anything is to obscure it. You're not bringing it out into the open. When they talk about illumination or enlightenment, it's something they talk about, but it's not something they actually practice. And you start seeing the same things in Christianity or a lot of Christian sects, and it's mostly because this is the kind of society we have here in America. It's, you know, Christianity is like 3,000 miles wide from coast to coast and about a quarter inch deep. But you'll see, well, the religion itself says this and this, but what they say and what they do are two different things. You can never weigh a warlock by what he says. You have to judge the tree by its fruit. You know, if it says oranges and it's producing apples, you got to go with apples.
Right. Well, yes.
Yeah, but in this culture, they insist it's oranges.
Well, sort of like the Republicans when they say they have, you know, our best interests at heart, when really all they care about is the rich and the corporations.
That's very warlock.
Very warlock.
In fact, the Rothschilds, the Sinclairs, that a lot of these people, a lot of the conspiracy theorists are pointing to, they're warlock families. They're mage families for ages. They're old families like ours. And they've been passing down their power and their money and their craft for ages. And they're still in power today, and they're still making kings and nations go wherever they want them to go.
So, are we talking about the Illuminati or the Bilderbergers and all of those people too? I mean, we're talking about all of them as well.
Yep. All over the world. They've been in power since – If you follow their – look at them. Check the things out that I said on some of their families. They've been around for ages, and they've always been in power.
Okay. Well, John, we're about out of time. And is there anything we haven't that I haven't asked you that I should have? I mean, is there something important that you want to make sure you share before we have to say goodnight?
Well – I'm about halfway through my third book, so if you've read books one and two, I hope to have the third one out before the end of the year if I can.
Well, in your YouTube videos, tell people you've started to put some YouTube videos out to teach about this.
Yes, I have. I got about four or five of them now, and of course, there's a little 40-second commercial for the book series. The book series. Well, the nice thing about it is fantasy, but it is based on reality. You can, if you're a muggle, you can sit down and you can enjoy a good fantasy, and I guarantee you when you put the books down, you will actually know something about witches.
Okay.
I mean, real witches and real witchcraft. It may be a fantasy, but you're going to understand witches.
And if you're a witch, you'll get a sense of what you're missing in this life, because you're probably or potentially a shadow of what your ancestors were.
I think so. There's ways that we're brought up that we get trained in and that we do as part of raising our kids, which you would have found, and so many of you would have found so much more helpful. A lot of things you had to pull through without much knowledge or with only a little clue here or there. I mean, my hat's off to all of you. I'm not being condescending. I mean that really, because I wouldn't be able to come out of the broom closet if not for you. But the things that you had to do without somebody there. See, I had my grandmother, when I got up in the morning, talk to me about my dreams at breakfast, before they faded. And I did that with my kids. And there's things that we do. For one, it creates left and right brain connections. So if you have intuitive abilities, they get better because mm-hmm. you get more, you develop more neural pathways to do those things.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, there's just so much you could have got growing up.
Well, now, how
and
do
you'll
we
see
find,
that in the books.
How do you find the YouTube videos? What do you look under?
My particular account is Witchman53.
Okay. So if they put that in the search, your YouTube videos will come up, Witchman.
Right.
What was it? Witchman what? What was the number?
Witchman 53.
Witchman 53. And your essay.
Stevie Tyler kind of saddled me with that.
And in your essay, how would one find, what is it called, The Witch's Voice or something like that? Is that what it's called?
What, on my essay, that's witchclan.com.
Witchclan.com. Okay, wonderful.
Yes.
Well, John, I know it was difficult for you to make time for us tonight. I really do appreciate it. I think you've really sort of given a different context and a perspective for what's going on out there in the world. I don't know if there's an organized effort for all of this, all of this glamour, all of this this dumbing down, this spell, that seems to be cast over.
Working at it. It is not accidental.
Okay.
They are working at it. They're doing. You got a bunch of very intelligent men, and I mean, otherwise they'd be making the stupidest mistakes in the world, incredibly stupid, and they got to know better. And it's just too perfect. All these things fit together, and it brings about. They profit from it.
Well, you know what I'm sitting here thinking is, if we put this political scene in a magical occult context, then mm-hmm. I can't help but wonder if there is a binding on President Obama to prevent him from accomplishing everything he promised in the campaign. Now, maybe he never intended to. Okay, there's always that. Maybe we all thought he was going to do more than any human being could have done with the forces working against him. But I can't help but wonder if there is a binding being put on him.
I believe so. I believe that is with a lot of them. And there's certain ways that you got to live to avoid that binding. And nobody's taught those things anymore. In fact, if you have any kind of scruples like that whatsoever, people are going to tell you that's silly and old-fashioned.
Yeah.
But the thing is, much of our problems today are from old-fashioned.
Yeah.
They didn't get this way overnight. They got this way over time to build up this kind of power structure.
Well, John, if I might say, I think you were very lucky to have grown up in your matriarchal clan, and so many more of us would have benefited from those type of wise women, guiding us in the morning as we're eating our oatmeal, asking about our dreams, instead of saying, "Did you clean your room?"
Yeah,
I hear you. Well, John, listen, thank you so much for being on the show. I can't wait to actually look at your books, The Warrior of the Witch Clan and Matriarch of the Witch Clan. I know when
in fact,
I read
Warrior of the Witch Clan got me in trouble with the government.
Really? How was that? You have like 3 minutes here.
Oh, they told me I'd have problems, and now the IRS is messing with me over something I really don't owe them, but they don't care.
So, you said something on Facebook about they wouldn't let you leave the country. Was that a joke or was that serious?
No, they flagged my passport.
Can you say anything about that? I mean, how does one? I mean, you're not a terrorist. I mean, how does your passport get flagged?
I used to be involved in their MK Ultra program. Well, it's kind of a terrible thing to say because they tell me, well, you're always involved until you die. It was something I pulled out of a long time ago, got the heck out of when I understood what was going on. And
But it follows you. It just keeps following you.
Right. Yeah, they're not going to let me forget it. And basically, they believe they own me.
Oh.
My mom put me up for adoption when I was a baby, and they got me for a while, and then they got me for a while when I was a teenager for this remote viewing thing, and basically they think I don't intimidate.
and they want and they want people who they want sheeple.
Right. Right.
Right.
They want you to do what they tell them, and it's kind of, I'm not the kind of guy you can run like that. They try to make me regret my life, and sometimes I do a little, but for the most part, I just enjoy fighting back.
So you were a remote viewer for the government for a while?
Yeah, back in the early 70s.
Well, that's pretty cool.
In the late 60s, early 70s, huh?
Well, I don't know if I'm that remote viewing experience you shared with me, is that mm-hmm. something you can say over the air?
About when I was looking for Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, did you want to say anything about that real quick?
No, he was dead. He wasn't dead when I found him. I saw him when he died. Actually, there's some stuff coming out just now. In fact, that government's admitting he's been dead for a while. When I first came out with that a few years back. I saw him in a cave in Afghanistan. He was jaundiced. He was really sick looking. He was on they had like plastic hanging up on the walls to make like cubicles and that. They had some wires, electric lights run in, and this little army cot type thing. He was laying on one of those in a makeshift room. And about that time, I could hear a plane with a large, really bassy sounding engine, and it dropped a really huge bomb. I found out later it's called a daisy cutter, and a big piece of granite about the size of a house fell on Osama in his hospital cot there, and essentially he's a greasy smear inside a mountain. I don't think anybody's ever going to find his body or anything. You have to remove so much to get to it. I was hoping at the time to direct my son, who was in Afghanistan at the time, to his whereabouts and get this over with, but nobody was listening anyway, and they were telling me, it couldn't be. We just got an audio tape from him. And it's kind of like, why didn't you get a videotape? You know, they've been used to seeing him for so long, really great for the morale and all that. He could kind of wave it in our faces and that, and they're saying, well, we didn't want to be found out by anything we'd find in the videotape. It's like, look, if you're indoors, you could be indoors anywhere.
Right,
nobody's
right.
going to tell where you're at. It was a lousy excuse. Saying the audio tapes, well, it sounds a lot like them, and now they're starting to say, well, we kind of know he was dead for a while.
Well, I know that Bush was sort of, I think, caught off guard once, but while he was still president, somebody asked mm-hmm. him something about Osama, and he said, well, we don't really care about him anymore. And you know, it was just mm-hmm. the way he said it in such an offhanded way after searching for him for so long, and, you know, he's the real culprit, then suddenly it's like he's so insignificant. It wouldn't surprise me if we've known he's dead for a long time.
Yeah, the warlocks go back on their stories quite a lot. Like I say, they're manipulating things. They're making this happen. They want this. They're getting something from it. They're doing it on purpose. It's not, they're just dumb and wandered into this little thing and that. This is what they're doing on purpose.
Okay. Well, we're about to go off the air here. We have about 1 minute, and I'm going to have to say goodnight, John. It has been fun.
It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your perspective. I think when I watch the news now, I'm going to look at it with different eyes. And when I see one of these warlocks or oath breakers that we've talked mm-hmm. about talk, I think I'm going to look at them with different eyes too now.
That'll work, and it'll make a big difference. You'll see. Actually, a lot of our listeners will see the same things. You're going to notice. They're going to start noticing things they didn't before. It's going to make a difference.
Well, thank you, Johnny. Good night.
Have a good night and brightest blessings.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed the show with John Storm, and we probably only have about a minute left here. So I want to thank you for tuning in and let you know that next Wednesday we have Clarissa Pinkola Estes. She is the author of the book Women Who Run With the Wolves. She's going to be talking about the dangerous old woman archetype, the crone, the hag, the wise woman. So please make sure you tune in next Wednesday, and please continue to let me hear from you. I appreciate that. So good night, listeners, and until next week.